In 1987, a pregnant 16-year-old named Joy White gave birth to a little girl at Harlem Hospital Center in New York City. Although Joy and her 22-year-old boyfriend, Carl Tyson, had thought long and hard about whether they should keep the baby or not when she first got pregnant, from the very moment their daughter came into the world, they were obsessed with her. Named Carlina, she was this beautiful little bundle of joy, always smiling, always laughing. Joy and Carl couldn't have been more excited about being able to raise her together, and they had so many different things planned out in their minds that they wanted to do and experience with her. But little did the couple know, as they were holding Carlina in their arms for the very first time, someone else was watching their newborn daughter from afar, a complete stranger. And this stranger wanted their daughter for herself. My name is Andy Jang, and this is Hidden Stories. After Joy and Carl took their daughter home from the hospital, they began the long process of slowly figuring out how to take care of her and raise her. But although at first everything seemed perfectly normal, just 19 days after Carlina White was born, she suddenly came down with a terrifying 104-degree fever. When Joy and Carl frantically rushed their daughter back to Harlem Hospital Center asking what was happening to her, they were informed that Carlina had developed a really bad infection from accidentally swallowing some fluid when she was being born. As a result, due to her fragile and unstable condition, she had to stay at the hospital and receive antibiotics through an IV tube until her infection went away. When Joy heard about this, she was obviously extremely upset. As a 16-year-old girl who had literally just become a mom, she was terrified that her newborn daughter wouldn't make it, and was also really unhappy that she wouldn't get to be with her daughter while she was going through all of this. But as Joy was sobbing in the hallway outside of the pediatric ward where Carlina was being kept, worried sick about all these worst-case scenarios that could easily happen, a woman dressed in all white suddenly approached her, comforting her and telling her not to cry. She seemed to be some sort of nurse at the hospital, and when she reassured Joy that everything would be okay and that she didn't need to worry about anything, Joy was extremely grateful and suddenly felt a whole lot better about things. Although before she had been panicking and had no idea what she was going to do, the nurse's presence helped calm her and helped her look at things more logically. Realizing that there was nothing more that she could do for her daughter at the hospital, Joy decided to head back home with Carl to clean up and get some rest. She trusted that the medical staff would be able to take great care of Carlina and would be able to help her make a full recovery, so she went off to bed. But only a couple hours after Joy had just fallen asleep, she was suddenly jolted awake by a loud knock coming from her front door. When Joy and her mom went to go see who it was, they were surprised to see two detectives standing outside their house. Joy's heart immediately sank. She was convinced that Carlina had to have died, and the detectives were there to inform them of the news. But although the detectives told Joy that that wasn't the case, what they said had actually happened was even more horrifying. Turns out, sometime between 2:30 and 4 a.m. that night during a shift change, someone had stolen Joy's daughter from her room in the hospital, and she was now missing. The detective said that although the hospital had surveillance cameras, they were broken, so no one knew who the kidnapper was or where they had gone off to. However, they said that they were doing their best to investigate everything as soon as they could, and they then asked Joy whether she knew anyone who would do such a thing, or whether she had any other potential leads. But by then, Joy wasn't even thinking straight anymore. This was her worst nightmare come to life. This was worse than her worst nightmare, and she was sobbing uncontrollably, just unable to comprehend the fact that her daughter was really gone. When Joy and her mom arrived back to the hospital, along with Joy's boyfriend Carl, they found numerous police officers and detectives running all over the entire building, with numerous dogs and even helicopters combing through the surrounding areas. However, no matter who they asked, it seemed like no one knew anything at all, and that no new evidence had been uncovered yet. It wasn't until Joy herself started thinking about the time that she had spent at the hospital the day before that the very first lead in the case was finally uncovered. As it turns out, the woman wearing white who had reassured Joy, the woman who Joy had thought had been a nurse, hadn't been a nurse at all. Apparently, many people had seen this woman always hanging out in the children's section of the hospital in the weeks leading up to Carlina's abduction. While all the patients and parents going through the children's section had assumed that she was just a hospital worker, all the actual hospital workers had assumed that she was just a patient or a parent. And since a person matching this strange woman's description had been seen leaving the hospital that night at around 3:30 a.m., shortly after Carlina had disappeared from her bed, this woman soon became the number one suspect in the case. In hindsight, it was clear that all along, for whatever reason, this woman had been secretly watching each of the children moving in and out of the hospital, waiting to find one that would be a good fit to steal. The woman hadn't been trying to comfort her, Joy realized. She had simply been trying to get her to leave so that she could steal her baby. But although the police soon launched a massive search to find the woman, since there was very little information on her outside of an extremely rough sketch of her face that was made by Joy and the other witnesses, they had very little luck. Every lead that came in soon went cold, and even though detectives put up pictures of Carlina White all around the areas near the hospital, hoping that someone would recognize her, no one did. In the days and weeks following the abduction, Joy did everything she could to bring more attention to the case, giving countless interviews about her story to the local press. For her, the loss of her daughter had been beyond devastating. She was always crying and had to start taking pills because she could no longer fall asleep at night. But despite Joy's efforts, as years went by and still no new information came to light, the case of Carlina White was soon forgotten by the public. But although Joy and Carl tried to move on with their lives as well, they just couldn't. In Joy's own words, there's something that you can't explain when you have a missing child. It always stayed with me. She was always on my mind. I always wondered where she was at. I would get on trains and I would just look at girls and I would think that maybe that's her. In the end, the constant stress of having their newborn child stolen from them was simply too much for Joy and Carl to handle. Since they were both still so young, all the pain, anguish, regret, and devastation that they felt from losing Carlina began to slowly drift into their own relationship, and as a result, they soon broke up. Despite this, however, they both later agreed to still work together to sue Harlem Hospital Center for their negligence in letting their baby be abducted. In Joy and Carl's eyes, the hospital was completely at fault. If they'd even just slightly better security, it simply would have never been possible for Carlina to have been kidnapped so easily. In 1992, 5 years after the kidnapping, a court agreed with them, and they won a settlement of $750,000 for the pain they had suffered, which was later reduced to $162,643 per parent. But although this was a ton of money, it still didn't make up for the loss of their daughter. Since Joy and Carl had both never given up hope, firmly believing that Carlina was still alive and that she would be found someday, they decided to place some of the money in a trust fund for her so that she could have it when she came back. Then, Joy just kept on doing her part, giving interviews about the story whenever she could, doing her best to keep the case alive. Although she had pretty much already accepted the fact that the police wouldn't be able to solve the case, she really believed that if she kept on pushing Carlina's story out into the world, one day Carlina herself would come across it and that she would recognize that she was this missing child. As years turned into decades, Joy still refused to give up this last shred of hope. She desperately, more than anything, just wanted to know where Carlina was, what she was up to. She figured that Carlina must have been far, far away from her by then. But little did Joy know, this entire time, her daughter had just been around an hour away. Now, before I continue with the story, this show is sponsored by BetterHelp. All of my closest friends know me as this sort of chronic overthinker. All these random and just completely irrational thoughts are always popping up inside my head without my control, and a lot of times it can get really, really overwhelming. It often just kind of feels like I'm just stuck inside my own head in this deeply negative loop of overthinking all these absolute worst-case situations about friendships, relationships, and really just everything else that happens in my life. Now, whenever I'm really overthinking something, and I'm sure some of you can probably relate, it's impossible for me to focus on anything. And by that point, all your emotions are just completely out of your control, and it kind of feels like the anxiety just completely engulfs you. But what I found, and what almost every other overthinker that I've talked to has also found, is that a really great way to get out of all these racing irrational thoughts is to just talk them through with someone. That can be with friends or with family, but also through therapy. Therapy is something that almost anyone can benefit from, not just people who have experienced major trauma. It can help you really talk through all of your worries, control your negative thinking cycles, and find that incredible mental and emotional peace. And now, with BetterHelp, it's never been easier to get started. One of the best things about BetterHelp is that it's entirely online, so you can get access to therapy straight from the comfort of your room. It's very quick and easy for you to get set up. It takes around 24 hours on average for you to be matched with a licensed therapist, and you can also switch therapists at any given time completely for free. Get a break from your thoughts with BetterHelp. You can visit betterhelp.com/hiddenstories today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/hiddenstories. Now, let's get back to today's story. On that fateful night back in 1987, a 26-year-old woman named Ann Petway walked out of Harlem Hospital Center, hiding a newborn baby underneath the intentionally thick clothes that she was wearing. Although she had tried having a baby herself several times in the past, she had always suffered a miscarriage, which made her terrified that she would never be able to ever be a parent. And since Ann was also scared that her boyfriend, a local drug dealer named Robert Nance, would leave her when he realized that she was incapable of having a baby, when she had yet another miscarriage, she decided that she would just have to steal someone else's baby and pretend that it was her own that she had just given birth to. Since Anne had been temporarily living alone away from her boyfriend and her family at the time that she had this latest pregnancy, when she suddenly brought this newborn baby girl back to her home in Bridgeport, Connecticut, no one questioned where the baby had come from. In their eyes, Anne had been pregnant, and now she had a daughter, so nothing at all seemed out of the ordinary. As a result, when Anne's daughter herself began to grow up and get older, she too had no idea that Anne was not her real mother. Anne decided to name her Nedra, so her full name was Nedra Nance, but her friends and family had always called her Nettie. Since she grew up surrounded by a lot of family members, during her childhood, Nettie was always at family events, having cookouts, parties, or just simply hanging out with her cousins, uncles, and aunts. Her best friend became her aunt Cassandra, Anne's sister, who she would spend hours studying new dance moves with and dreaming together about their future lives. But although she had a relatively happy childhood, it wasn't without its dark moments. Her mom, Anne, was a drug addict who was often under the influence and would severely beat her from time to time. But although Anne could be extremely strict, Nettie figured that she just had to do what she had to do as a parent. In the area where she grew up, it was completely normal for parents to hit their kids, so even as a teenager, Nettie never really held that against her mom. Despite everything, she greatly cared for and loved Anne, never knowing that her real mom was just 45 miles away, still desperately looking for her. As Nettie continued to get older, though, she began to become more and more aware of the fact that she and her mom, Anne, looked absolutely nothing alike. For one, Anne was dark-skinned and Nettie was light-skinned. However, although this had always been a bit puzzling to her, Nettie had no reason to question anything or to suspect that something was up. As a result, it wasn't until 2005, when Nettie suddenly found herself pregnant at the age of 17, that the reason she looked so different from her mom was finally revealed. Although her baby hadn't been planned, Nettie and her boyfriend were really excited about becoming parents together. However, since Nettie needed her birth certificate to get free prenatal care from the state, she soon went to Anne to ask for hers, since she had never really known her dad, who only came by every now and then. When she did, though, to Nettie's surprise and confusion, Anne kind of just brushed her off, telling her not to worry about it and that she would help handle it. Nettie couldn't understand why her mom couldn't just give her her birth certificate and why she had to go and just overcomplicate things. And when some time had gone by and Anne still hadn't done anything, Nettie just got tired of waiting. She decided to simply go through Anne's belongings herself, and she soon came across a document with her name and birth date on it. But when Nettie took this document to the local Bureau of Vital Statistics in New Haven, Connecticut, and presented it as her birth certificate to receive her free healthcare, she was shocked to be told by the clerk to leave immediately before they called the cops. The clerk told Nettie that her birth certificate was fraudulent, that it had been faked. And when Nettie stormed back home, furious, and confronted Anne about this, her mom suddenly burst into tears, apologizing to her. "Your mom left you," Anne told her, "and she never came back." Anne explained to Nettie that she wished that she could have told her sooner, but this didn't change anything. Her real mom hadn't cared about her, but Anne did, and that's why she had taken Nettie in as her own daughter. When Anne's words hit Nettie, her stomach felt sick. This wasn't her family, those weren't her cousins, that wasn't her grandma downstairs. Although she had a million questions and she began to ask Anne who her real mother was, where she had come from, why she abandoned her, and where she was now, Anne always had the same answer. "She left you and never came back." That was it, she insisted. She didn't know anything else and there was nothing more to it. However, Nettie was still curious. Although the rest of the Petway family had taken the news fairly well and had the same amount of love for Nettie and for Anne that they had always had, Nettie had trouble believing that Anne really didn't know anything about her biological mother, and she began to suspect that there was something more to the story. So, she began trying to do some digging on her own. When the Connecticut Department of Children and Families, or DCF, opened a file on her case to verify that Anne indeed wasn't her mother, Nettie tried asking her caseworker whether her DNA could be cross-referenced with some DNA database of missing children. However, her caseworker simply told her that's TV stuff and just informed Nettie that unfortunately they wouldn't be able to help her figure out her real identity. So, Nettie started researching local missing children cases herself. Since Anne had told her that she was born in New Haven, she began to look through all the unsolved stories in the state of Connecticut. When her dad, Robert Nance, who was in jail at the time, called Nettie and told her that no one had actually been with Anne when she had supposedly found Nettie abandoned, she became even more suspicious. However, since Nettie couldn't find any local missing children cases that matched her appearance, over time, other things started coming up, and she began to just move on with her life. Later that year, Nettie's daughter, Samani, was born. Soon afterwards, Nettie got her high school diploma, got a job as a motel desk clerk, and then later moved to Atlanta, where her best friend, her aunt Cassandra, had moved just a few years earlier. Although Nettie still stayed in contact with her adopted mother, Anne, she didn't feel nearly as close to her as they had been before she had learned that she was adopted. Deep down, she felt that a piece of her was missing. She felt that in order to move on with her life, she needed answers about who her biological mother was, about what had actually happened. Over the years, Nettie would still, from time to time, find herself browsing the internet for missing children cases, hoping that she would find something, anything of substance. But wherever she looked, the children in the photos wouldn't be her color, or just wouldn't look like her. Although she kept her investigations to herself at first, she eventually confided in her aunt Cassandra that she still wanted to know the truth. Despite being Anne's sister, Cassandra encouraged her to keep on searching for this truth, so Nettie did. Neither of them could have ever imagined just exactly what finding out this truth would mean for the woman who had raised Nettie, Anne Petway. The week before Christmas in 2010, Nettie, 23 by then, decided for the very first time to expand her search beyond the Connecticut area. It had suddenly dawned on her that her mom, Anne, could have been lying about her birthplace, and that in reality, she could have come from anywhere, really. However, as Nettie was combing through the missing children photo archives from the states surrounding Connecticut, one specific picture suddenly caught her eye. It was a photo of a baby girl named Carlina White, who strongly reminded Nettie of her daughter, Samani. Everyone had always told her that Samani looked just like her. And not only that, Carlina had vanished on August 4th, 1987, a date that was very close to Nettie's supposed birthday. When Nettie showed Cassandra the photo, her aunt confirmed that the baby did look a lot like her. However, since Nettie wanted to be absolutely certain that she was this missing baby before doing anything, she soon decided to call the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. She didn't mention finding the photo of Carlina White. Instead, she just stated that she suspected that the woman who she had thought was her mom had actually kidnapped her when she was born, and she just wanted to try and figure out who she really was. In Nettie's eyes, if the center could match her profile with Carlina White, even without her mentioning seeing the resemblance in the baby photo, she would know for certain that this was her true identity. Although Nettie was extremely frustrated and struggled a lot with answering some of the questions that the center asked her to try to pinpoint who she was, Cassandra helped her through it and eventually brought up the fact that Nettie had a distinct birthmark on her right arm. And when the specific birthmark was cross-referenced with the center's records of missing children, a single match was found to Nettie's profile, the cold case of Carlina White. In January 2011, more than 23 years after the night that Carlina White had been abducted from Harlem Hospital Center, Nettie was finally reunited with her parents, Joy White and Carl Tyson. When Joy and Carl saw their daughter again, they both could hardly believe their eyes and just couldn't stop crying out of sheer joy. Although Nettie wasn't crying herself, she felt the exact same way that they did. After all this time, she had finally done it. She had finally found her real parents, her real family, her real identity, and everything in her life was finally starting to make sense. All the missing puzzle pieces were finally starting to come together. However, although Nettie's first interactions with her parents over the phone and then in person made her unimaginably happy, her reunion with them very quickly soon went sour. Despite having received DNA confirmation that she was indeed Carlina White and that Joy and Carl were indeed her parents, Nettie soon began to feel incredibly homesick for her old family. As a result, to her parents' despair and frustration, after spending just a few days with them, she decided to book a plane ticket back to her home in Atlanta. However, the very day that Nettie arrived back, the news of her reuniting with her parents hit the internet, and it was blowing up everywhere. Since she had been missing for 23 entire years, it was the longest that any missing child had gone before being reunited with her parents again in American history by far. As such, every major news channel wanted a piece of her story, and before long, reporters began reaching out to Nettie, offering to fly her back to New York and to put her and her parents in a big fancy hotel for a proper reunion. Although Nettie agreed to this, it would turn out to be a horrible decision. Everywhere she went in New York, she was absolutely mobbed by the media. Reporters were booking rooms on her hotel floor just to get closer to her, and it got to the extent that she couldn't even leave her room without someone coming after her. Joy and Carl actually enjoyed the attention, telling the reporters that their dream had finally come true and that Nettie was more like them than they could have ever imagined. But although Nettie tried to be happy in front of the cameras as well, she just couldn't help but feel fake. She was being told to kiss her parents and hold their hands, things that she hadn't even done in private with them yet. She hated the attention, and she hated being always bombarded with questions from reporters wherever she went. And when the media began claiming that her kidnapper, Anne Petway, was an abusive drug addict who was an absolutely horrible mom in person, that was the last straw for Nettie. In her eyes, Anne had never been a bad mom. Anne had cared for her and done what she could to raise her the right way. And Nettie had said all of that to the news reporters, but they had just taken the small part of her story about physical abuse in her childhood and completely twisted it and blown it out of proportion to make everything seem more negative. At the time, Anne was on the run from the FBI, facing a federal prison sentence of 20 years to life. Nettie's parents, Joy and Carl, had absolutely zero remorse for her. As Joy put it, "I want her to suffer. I want her to do some time, like I suffered for 23 years. However, Nettie didn't feel the same way. Regardless of what happened, she still loved Anne and she still cared for her. As a result, shortly after the report on Anne broke, Nettie decided to go back to her old home of Atlanta, Georgia again. Joy and Carl couldn't believe it. They had never in a million years imagined that after they got their daughter back, she would be so willing to leave them once again, and it hurt them beyond belief. Back in Georgia, Nettie stopped calling her biological parents as often as she had been. Even at her old home, reporters just kept coming after her. Before long, Nettie had become so anxious from all the constant bombardment of attention that whenever anyone would approach her, she would just start to shake. She soon had to check into a hotel to avoid her house and all the press that was always there. As time went on, Nettie's relationship with Joy and Carl only continued to get worse. Although Nettie had long stopped giving interviews, Joy was still going at it. During one of these interviews, she accused Nettie of trying to actively distance herself from both her and Carl. During another interview, she claimed that Nettie had seemed less interested in reuniting with them when she found out that their trust fund for her had long been depleted of its money. But although Joy hadn't meant to attack Nettie in any way and she just wanted her daughter back, when Nettie found out about all these things that Joy had been saying behind her back, she was furious. Before long, she cut off all contact with Carl and Joy. And sometime after her kidnapper, Anne Pettway, finally surrendered herself over to the FBI, Nettie agreed to testify on her behalf, in support of her if needed. Despite this, however, on July 30, 2012, Anne Pettway was sentenced to 12 years in prison. During her hearing, she apologized to Joy and Carl, saying, "I am deeply sorry for what I've done. If you don't accept it, it's understandable. I'm here to right my wrong." A short while after Nettie had cut off contact with her biological parents, she reached back out to them and made up with them. She agreed with them that they had started off on the wrong foot with lots of misunderstandings and that it'd be nice to try and start fresh. However, it's unknown how close Nettie and her parents have gotten and how close they still are to this day. Since her last encounters with the press, Nettie has lived an almost entirely private life. During one of the last interviews she gave, though, she said that despite everything, she was happy to finally know the entire truth. She said that although she was going to keep her legal name as Carlina White, she would still tell everyone that her name was Nettie. In her eyes, Nettie wasn't the name that her old family or her new family gave her. It was the name she gave herself, and she was going to keep it. With that being said, I hope you found today's story interesting. If you did, please share this episode with friends who might enjoy it as well. Comment your thoughts and leave a rating. It goes a long way and really helps make this entire thing possible. To read the Hidden Stories program disclaimer, ethics policy, and verification and licensing terms, go to human-content.com/hiddenstories. That's human-content.com/hiddenstories. I'll see you guys soon.